Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and good night, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Endurance Chat. I am Floodman11, and joining me today is Trevor Vasaurus. How are you going, Trevor Vasaurus?
Good, good.
Awesome. How are you settling into everything at the moment?
I know where my seat is. I know where the canteen is.
Do you know where to get good coffee or good tea, because you're in your UK?
I have found the optimal coffee machine that gives the more espresso than the others, and sometimes you need it.
So. Perfect. So you found everything important in life. Good. I'm happy for you. Anyway, we're back after a little bit of a break, and that's entirely on me. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. Just life is just too much at the moment, but it's okay because we're back and we're talking WEC today. We're going to wrap up everything that happened all that time ago in Fuji before looking at the first release of the 2020-2021 hypercar-ish silhouette thing, which is going to become the new LMP1 for that regulation cycle. Give a little bit of an overview and some thoughts before looking ahead to the upcoming weekend's race at Shanghai. So let's crack straight into the WEC at Fuji. And I think the most typical thing about that weekend was your classic Fuji-san weather, right? It's just you can't even start the race properly because it was raining again and again. And it wasn't even raining like the entirety of the weekend before that. Why? It just seems that the WC at Fuji and rain just go together like cookies and cream, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty iconic duo. Yeah, you've got to expect the wet tires being used that race, which was interesting. The SMP going into that race having never driven a BR1
in the wet at all, like never
at all. Going into Fuji that's a pretty big risk.
Yeah, definitely. It seemed to work very well for them in the beginning. They started on the wet tires as the track sort of dried out a little bit. But that actually vaulted them to the lead once the first of the pit stoppers start to take. I think it was the number 7 and the number 8 pitted early. I think the 7th before the 8 to put on new wets because they burnt through the wets. And then all of a sudden we had SMP Racing in the lead of the race. It was like, what? Huh? Who did that? It was really cool, though.
It was pretty interesting in that the Toyotas, they couldn't generate tire temperature, so they didn't use up per se the wet tires. They were just too cold and basically effectively useless.
Yeah, they were so effectively bricks.
Yeah, come in to just put new blanket warm tires on just to help them out, and it was still too wet to change to intermediates. So SMP avoided that early stop, but then they also avoided a stop to intermediates and went straight to slicks.
Yep.
Which also saved them some time in the pit lane.
And it was helped by the rather unfortunate but quite catastrophic tire blowout down the main straight of Fuji Speedway from the MR Racing Ferrari. That was one of the craziest things I think I've ever seen. It's up there with the, I think it was the JCDC car at Le Mans this year, where the tire just exploded under just maximum revolutions and no load and just disintegrated the entire rear end of the car. It was nuts. I can't really, unless it had driven over some debris from another car. I think the commentators made mention that the number 11 SMP Racing car, the one that wasn't in the lead of the race, had actually lost a wheel at that point. So it could have driven over some sort of debris and then punctured the tire, which let go on the main straight. But by gosh, it was terrifying to see that disintegrate, wasn't it?
Yeah, the driver pretty much had no indication. I mean, if it was a slow puncture, I guess they have sensors for the engineers on the wall to notice something going on. But yeah, the driver's pretty much
Yeah, like you couldn't do anything. And unfortunately, I think it was who was it in the car? Might have been Ishikawa, I recall.
I think it was, yeah, yep. Ishikawa. Yeah.
And couldn't get around back to the pits. Had to park the car up, put us under safety car, and it was just at the sort of tipping point for where you were like, do you want to put on slicks or not? And so a lot of the drivers, a lot of the teams came in and put slick tires on. But then we had another quite interesting moment where the championship pretender from the privateers, the number three Rebellion, driven by Gustavo Menezes at the time, threw itself into the wall. 100% just disintegrated as it hit the wall under safety car. And put that car out of the race. It was astonishing to watch. I don't think I've ever seen a car mess up that badly under safety car in all of my years watching motorsports.
Yeah, it came out of nowhere. It was just exiting turn one.
Mm.
A little bit of a bump. I don't think it was really the curbs because you're on the...
It was in the middle of the road, yeah.
Yeah, and just snapped one way, then caught it, snapped the other way, and... Like you said, wet weather, as soon as you touch the grass, like it's just soaking wet. I was checking the watching the replay, and like the 4x4 recovery team truck was like wading through puddles and stuff. So yeah,
it was pretty bad. Yeah. And what do you think caused that? I mean, because you'd think under safety car, you're going at a set speed. The track might have been a little damp, and the off track was very damp. You're right, but how does one go from being on track and following the track to going off that extravagantly at that speed?
Well, I trust Menezes' talent, so I don't think it's just too much right foot on the accelerator coming out of the first corner. But also you've got weight transfer going over a bump. And also we just mentioned Toyota's coming in for lack of tire temperature. These guys are going around under the safety car under the safety car. Tire temperature, generating tire temperature is somewhat critical.
Mm. And they did just go through the pits as well. Because of the debris on the main straight, they actually took all the cars through the pits. So, yeah, do you think that might have been it as well?
Yeah, and also, I'm not sure at that stage of the race, actually, but pickup was quite severe, quite strong with the, like, tyre marbles.
Yep.
And, yeah, maybe some dirty tyres as well.
Mm. So, yeah, that put out one of the Rebellions in the this was within the first hour of racing as well. So, really not what Rebellion were looking for in their fight to be the top privateer for this super season. But we did get underway just before the hour mark. And from that point on, it was pretty much what we were expecting in terms of, you know, the Toyotas pushing their way to the front and being sort of unchallengeable. But the 17, oh, sorry, was it the 17 or the 11? I feel like it was the 17 car, because it was Sarrazin in the car, who was a bunch of laps down after losing that wheel, actually was able to chase the two Toyotas and actually pass the number 7 going from the main straight into turn 1, which was astounding. We were absolutely blown away watching it at the time because I think that was the first legitimate pass that a privateer had made on one of the Toyotas for the season. So I want to pose this question to you. Was the EOT between the Toyotas and the privateers correct or at least more correct for this weekend?
Well, it's down to personal judgment, really, with being correct or not, down to how much of an advantage do you deem is acceptable or not for the hybrids based on investment, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
Or, you know, we've talked about this for ages ever now. And the gap on track, it's still there on pace. There are some instances that the privateers can be faster. For example, if you imagine like a split tire strategy, maybe but also down to areas on the track. The like you were mentioning with Sarrazin overtaking the Toyota, I think it was Kobayashi in the car?
Yes, I think so.
Kobayashi boosted out of the last corner onto the straight, easily overtook the SMP, and then the SMP just went back into its slipstream and shot right past it at the end of the straight when the Toyota was fully into lifting coast. And so they had to then change, the Toyotas both had to change their boost strategy whenever they came up behind a privateer, just because of this reason. They wouldn't be able to shake off the privateers, because then the privateer would block them coming out of the first corner and potentially slow them down for the rest of the lap. So to cleanly get past or create a gap, they changed the boosting strategy to boost as soon as they passed the start finish line halfway down the straight, to then use some of the new allocation of energy that they are given past the start finish line on the new lap.
Yep.
This is suboptimal for a qualifying lap, let's say, because you're not using the energy to its most
efficient,
the highest advantage. But they had to do what they've got to, what they had to do to kind of equalize or neutralize the advantage that the privateers had in that certain instance.
It was pretty interesting seeing live the massive difference between the way the privateers were making their pace and the Toyotas. But we still saw, of course, the Toyotas be the better car to be in, which is, of course, what you expect. But was it closer than we saw at Silverstone over the course of a lap?
It should be equalized even more. The trouble is, it's not necessarily as equal with the changing conditions and the positive of having four-wheel drive. Looking at the pit stop numbers as well, the Rebellion crew were able to match the pit stop times, coming from Le Mans, where there was a 6-lap lead in the pits, regardless of what happened on the track, having the ability of a privateer crew being able to match and go head to head with a factory a factory hybrid crew, that is a big positive.
Yeah. So Rebellion were the number car was in the end the better of the privateers over the course of the race. But they were basically the only privateer that ran without problems. The three SMP / Dragon Speed cars all ran into issues. We've already mentioned the number 17 car with the wheel hub, but we also had the number 11 come to a grinding stop just at the bottom of the Yokohama corner. I think it's the one, basically where they've got the little kinky chicane in the bottom of the hill. I think that was from third place, or from the battle of third place, which put that car out of the race. And then the number, I think that was the 17 car. The number 11 also ran into issues, which was, I'm trying to find it here. An alternator belt issue cost them multiple laps in the pits towards the second half of the race, but they were able to fight back and finish in fourth ahead of the Bicolors car, which ran without incident, but also ran 4 to 5 laps down on the Rebellion. And then the Dragon Speed car also had a very similar issue there to the number 11 car, where it just came to a grinding halt and just couldn't get going again. So I just want to talk about this privateer battle, because we've talked about the fact that it's very much Rebellion versus SMP for the top privateer honors. Now, I want to ask you, in your opinion, who's built a better car? Or, sorry, who's built a faster car? We'll start with that.
Based on, well, it's difficult to compare because of the varying circuits and what they're, ultimately designed for is going around them on. And the differences in aero kits, with SMP having the really ultra low drag kind of look. I like both. I like the simplicity of the Rebellion. Naturally aspirated, simple, relatively simple engine. The SMP is more untested. And they're having more untested in terms of, building from a base.
Yeah, brand new base and new engine as well with the AER, which I think is not brand new, but new for an LMP1 application like this.
Yeah, and I also believe if I understand correctly, the some of the work that went into creating the Joker Orica 07 LMP2 kit was transferred, some of that knowledge into the
Rebellion
Rebellion
R13, yeah.
P1 development. So you could argue that they've had people kind of thinking about these upgrades for basing on an LMP2 chassis for a longer time. In terms of looks, I love both. I mean, the SMP is just so aggressive, and like they're adding little flicks, little extra bits here and there, from Silverstone onwards. Yeah, they mean business.
So, but in terms of which would be faster on a track over a race, which would you say? You just kind of pointing towards more the Rebellion? That's the
Well,
sort of impression I got.
based on this race, it's quite awkward because Rebellion, they pretty much could just sit in and do low risk strategy, and just kind of coast, because they knew they weren't gonna really take it to the two Toyotas at the end of the race, whereas the SMPs were pretty much go to catch the
By
Bycolis
Collis, yep.
to get some extra points for the class. The SMP was really lighting up the time sheets, in the second half of the race. So yeah, the pace is there. And also the SMP at the end of the straights, looked to have a few extra Ks on the Rebellion. So, it might have a bit more extra power from that engine, especially considering how aggressive and large in terms of frontal area that re their rear wing is. To be able to have such a high top speed with an aggressive aero package versus the Rebellion, I believe it was the number one at the time that it was overtaking, that also had some dive planes removed to get a kind of extra top speed on the straight. To be able to do that,
And still
is
be
pretty
quicker,
impressive.
yeah. I actually think, in saying all this, I actually think the SMP is a faster car and a better car. I just don't think that it's been. I think the reliability has actually been the biggest thing that's been detracting from their pace, or rather their results this season. Because if you think about it, they were definitely in the hunt at Silverstone until one of their cars broke down. They were there or thereabouts at Spa until Izakian flipped over. And here, I think they were actually the better of the two privateer cars, but they just keep running into problems. So I wonder, this is going to be a bit of a far out call, but I wonder, come next season after Le Mans, or even next year's Le Mans, if the SMP will actually leave the Rebellion a bit behind. I think it will be a very interesting thing to continue to keep track of over the future, because at the moment Rebellion is just much more consistent, and using the R13, which is based off of the Orica 07 chassis, is probably helping that. But yeah, you been looking quite a fair bit into things like the aero kits and that sort of stuff for your little sports car engineering blog that you do. Have you seen more development on the SMP side than the Rebellions?
They both kind of had, you know, major changes.
Okay.
Between, you know, the obvious, more apparent change between the high and low drag kits. But yeah, the SMP has added a few little extra bits here and there, but that I've commented on, but not really anything significant. The only real significant change that's happened to the only development recently, rather, because these aero kits were pretty much locked in before Le Mans, was the Bicolis, and they're making some changes. But yeah, it's pretty stable at the minute. I hope we have something new on the cars to have a look into at Shanghai. But if not, there's a nice long time over Christmas period to try and work on some new stuff. Yeah, exactly, for Sebring. So hopefully, if we don't have anything next race, there'll be definitely some time to get some new bits on the car.
Cool. So to wrap up LMP1, it was the number 7 who took their first win of the season for Conway Kobayashi and Jose Maria Lopez, ahead of the number 8, taking home a Toyota 1-2 at their home track in Fuji, which, again, no one was really surprised by. The number 1 car ran a generally faultless kind of under-the-radar race to finish in 3rd, and the recovering number 11 SMP took home 4th position ahead of the Bicolors. And I think, I am just going to double-check before I make a fool out of myself, but I think the other cars in the field all were unclassified. So I'm just going to double check.
Yeah, 10, 17, and 3 were not classified.
Yep, there you go. So, yeah, as I mentioned, not great for the 17 or the 10 in terms of just reliability issues for that BR engineering chassis. And then the Rebellion, of course, we mentioned, had that accident. I want to jump now to GT, because I have to say, early on in the race, even throughout the race, in fact, that GT battle between all of the cars was absolutely peak GT racing and some of the best racing I've ever seen, especially in that early section where there was tire issues, there was weather and all that sort of stuff. It really made for a great GT race. And I just wanted to, just to focus a bit on that, because at one point we had the two Aston Martins leading, BMW in the mix, Ferrari in the mix, Ford in the mix, and Porsche in the mix. And come the end of the race, we had 4 different manufacturers in the top 4. And the only ones to really miss out were the Aston Martins after just some poor tire choices and strategy choices, I guess, throughout the race. But it was really, really good to sort of see the much more level balance and level playing field of the GT class at Fuji. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. GT race, it's good to have the amount of GT excitement that we had at Fuji, because it does sort of lift the overall event, I think. What were your thoughts on the GT race?
I'm thankful of, maybe not, but it was kind of adding a little spice that Ferrari weren't allowed to kind of walk away with the win, because they had the best car for that race on pace as a viewer, in terms of getting like a more balanced kind of battle. Having the 71, I think it was have a little problem and little time in the garage, it kind of added a little extra to the rest of the class all the way down.
Yep. I want to ask about the BOP between, for example, the BMW and the rest of the field. We finally, I think for the first time, have seen an event where you could almost say all of the manufacturers had a chance at winning, which is not something that we've had for the rest of the season. I mean, BMW only finished fifth at Silverstone, and that was over a lap off the pace. Aston Martin, we saw glimpses of them doing well at Silverstone, but they weren't able to hold onto their tyres well enough. Whereas here, especially for the first stint, Aston Martin actually in qualifying qualified on pole, which was astounding, to say the least. But it looked like there was a lot more parity across the class, which I think, yeah, as I said, is good. And it's kind of good to see the likes of BMW and Aston Martin be a bit more competitive, because, yeah, it's much more fun having four different marks in the top four or five different marks in the top five than it is having it be a bit of Noah's Ark. Do you think that this sets a good precedent for the rest of the season? Do you think we finally hit on the good baseline for the BOP for the rest of the season, or do you think there's still a bit more work?
Well, if you take BMW and Aston Martin as a little example versus the rest of the class, you know, instead of being a kind of laughing stock at Spa for Aston Martin, they've got a kind of upward trend up to everyone else. Now they've got arguably some of the best qualifying performance out of the class, but not so much in race pace yet. Yeah, it's getting there. It takes a while for new cars to be going through the auto BOP system, but as that learns, the performances relative to the rest of the class, then I believe that it will have a trend to getting better as the season goes on.
Yeah, and we've sort of seen that already, and yeah, I hope it does get a little better. I think it still needs to get a little better though. But Aston Martin did kind of shoot themselves in the foot by pitting off strategy at the first stint. Everyone kind of came in with a safety car and they really didn't, which kind of left them out on the wets for the second stint of the race, and they just kind of got swallowed up after that, which is why they were only able to fight back to sixth and ninth for the two Aston Martins. Only just a lap off the pace as well, which isn't too bad. But yeah, it was looking like the number 71 was going to be the car that was most in the mix between the 82 and the 92 for the race win. But as you mentioned, they had a bit of time in the garage because middle of the race, I think it was about 2.5 to 3 hours left, they actually had a bit of a collision with the number 31 Dragon Speed car heading down the bottom of the hill, which broke the rear suspension on that car and forced both cars into the garage, in fact. So it was, yeah, as you said, they looked like they had the best car for the race, but it was a bit of luck this time, not BOP, as James Collado likes to harp on about, that sold them the poor result. But still, James Collado managed to find a reason to complain about it because we all know how much James Collado likes to have a bit of a whinge. just quick sidebar, speaking of, we've got the BOP table already for Shanghai this weekend, and guess what's happened, guys? Yeah, Ferrari's gained a bit of weight, so Collado's going to have something to complain about again, which I guess we're all excited for, aren't we? Yeah, brilliant. At the end of the day, the Porsche seemed to really come alive, not only as the track was drying off, but once the track was dry, and that 92 car took the win by only 12 seconds ahead of the number 82 BMW. And then it was the number 67 Ford that took home third. The 51 in fourth, 91 in fifth, and then aforementioned Aston Martins, and then the sister cars for the other brands. I reckon it was actually very interesting that it seemed like the Porsche and the Ford had a K or two extra down the straight compared to the other cars. Now, do you think that was due to better corner exits or just a bit more horsepower? Because I didn't really notice. Yeah, go ahead.
According to the commentary, I noted down them saying that the Ford had more weight and less boost for this race versus a kind of baseline. You could argue more weight, more mechanical grip, and then on corner exit, because before the aero kind of takes control, and then less boost. Yeah, it did kind of fall off, especially compared to the Porsches, which seemed to have the best top end on the straights. Yeah, I think they had some good performances, but then yeah, the Ferrari was much better pretty much everywhere else other than the straight. They seemed to have really good tire performance and nice downforce, like, you know, nice mid-corner performance.
Yeah, and it looked like the Ferrari had the better car everywhere except the straight line lines. Now, I've just, as a bit of a sidebar, had a look at the event maximum speed for the entire weekend. The Aston Martin and the BMW, which seemed to have the best top speed, reaching 276 for the BMW and 279 for the Aston Martin. So it looked like they had a bit more pace than everyone else. But we were talking about the 911 RSR having the best pace, but they were, you know, sort of mid-pack at the speed trap. So who knows what's going on, man? Actually,
might have had a nice little slipstream there for the
Aston Martin,
Martin to get, you know, 3 kph over everyone else.
Mm. Yeah, real odd in that one. But yeah, it goes to show how much we know, guys. Yay. So we'll jump across to LMP2 now, and this was a race that was really dominated by one team, and that was the JCDC team. And I was just blown away come the end of the race that how far ahead they were compared to everyone else, because it looked like they did it just so effortlessly. Do you have any sort of idea as to how they did that?
So we'll start on the amateur driver performance. Now you must be asking which amateur, because the number 37 has got 2 silvers, amazingly, and they still won the race.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
So we'll start off with that. So by plotting the just comparing the amateur drivers against each other, the big 3 or 4 best performers are the 2 JCDC cars, the Signatec Alpine car, and then I think it's Gonzalez in the Dragon Speed.
Yep.
They're the by far the best performing drivers, and out of those, you could argue the most consistent are the JCDC cars.
Mm. So yeah.
So they have pretty much the best driver lineups in terms of having the best
amateurs.
Best worst driver.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. The best worst driver. So you've chucked together a few graphs showing these trends on your sports car engineering blog, which, by the way, everyone should check out because it's great. So for the 37s stints, whose laps did you actually use? Was it Weyron Tans or Nabil Jeffrey?
I think I used Weyron Tans.
Yep.
I did M and R over which one to use, because they are both silvers. So it's pretty interchangeable, but I think I used the slower of the two to be a sort of catch-all.
Okay.
To prove that I've kind of picked the slowest of the drivers.
Yeah, because it looks like that the 37 actually was probably the best performing amateur over the entire race, based on these trend lines, which is, if that's the worst of the two drivers, the two silvers in that car, that's phenomenal for them. And that's kind of come, maybe not out of nowhere, but certainly not what you'd expect when you've got, say, the 36 car, which has got Nicolas Lapierre, Andre Negrau, and Pierre Thierry behind the wheel. If your worst driver is better than Pierre Thierry, you're doing something damn right, I gotta say.
And another good thing about having it this way around and finding, you know, two diamonds in the rough is next sort of driver classification, when the drivers get reclassified, if they are reclassified, you've got two to hope that one of them stays as a silver.
Yeah.
If one of those two stays as a silver, then you keep your same driver lineup and you get a nice consistency there, and you don't have a new driver that's kind of getting used to the team. So if one of the two stays silver next period of driver classification, then, you know, there's some real consistency there.
They were friggin' laughing. Great. And I think it was, additionally, it was very cool to see the Malaysian staffed car, the Jasmine Jaffar, Nabil Jeffrey, were in tan car, take a win, especially after the 38 took the last one at Silverstone, which was, of course, the mighty 38 Jota Sports sort of hunting grounds, whereas Fuji is a lot closer to Malaysia, I saw a not insignificant amount of Malaysian flags in the stands as well. So that was really, really cool to see. And for someone who's been keeping track of Jasmine Jaffar's career since his early Blank Pain days, that was also great to see him take a World Endurance Championship win. So great job for the 37 to take home that victory. So if you got any other sort of diamonds in the rough to talk about in the LMP2 class?
Well, we also have not only the time being made by the drivers on out on track, but we also have how good the crews are in the pit lane. So the Jota Sport, however you want to say it, their consistency in the pit lane was really, really, really good. Regardless of, or even including the extra sort of, not really extra, but the very short first stint for both the 37 and the 38, they managed to have lower cumulative total pit lane time than teams that didn't do an early extra stop. So, for example, a team that went straight from wets to intermediates to slicks, they still managed to do that faster than a team going from potentially wets to slicks.
So, like the Alpine or the Labra car?
Yeah. Hmm. I believe the Alpine and the Labra went from wets to
slicks.
Slicks. But I do remember the Signatec spinning on intermediates.
So. I was just about to mention the same thing. Early on in the piece, just after the safety car went back into the pits, I remember seeing Nicolas Lapierre spin it out from, I think it was the lead of the race at the time, which then dropped them down to about fifth or sixth. So they actually had to pull their way back up the field after that mistake. But in saying that, though, the number 38 also had quite a moment around turn four, which almost put them into the wall. But they were lucky enough to sort of half slide back onto the track. So it was a bit treacherous in those early conditions. And I don't think anyone in those early conditions got them as wrong as the Team Netherlands car with Fritz van Erd behind the wheel in that early segment of the race. It was a bit of a madhouse, wasn't it?
Well, he was extremely frustrated on the an interview in the pit lane with a camera, and they got a camera with a pretty long lens to get his kind of raw emotion at the back of the garage. He was for some reason put out on slick tires straight from wets, and it might have been one of the first teams to go on slicks, maybe.
Yeah, I think it was.
no offense to him, but in terms of being naturally talented, I don't want to say too much, but he would not necessarily be the first driver you'd think that you want to put slip.
Let's call it quite an ambitious decision in that case. Considering that,
yeah, maybe.
Considering that he'd already spun out before the start of the race, making his way to the grid.
Yeah. yeah, I think that was a bit of foreshadowing, unfortunately.
Yeah. Wasn't the best for them, but the Dragon Speed car was also the next car that probably had a chance, but as we mentioned, they round up in a bit of trouble with the 71 car, which did put both of them into the pits for a little bit of time. In fact, the Dragon Speed car lost, I think it was 14 laps come the end of the race, or 12 laps. Yeah, 12 laps. Which put them down to sixth. So the race in LMP2 ended up 37-38. Then the 36 car, the Signatec Alpine car, which kind of held third for most of the race after recovering from that earlier spin. The TDS racing car came home in fourth ahead of the Labra competition car, then the cars that had problems, the 31 and the 29. Just a quick sidebar, I want to talk quickly about the LMP2 championship, because at the moment, it is so tight at the front. The only difference between the 36 car, which is leading the championship, and the two Jackie Chan DC cars is the pole position that the Alpine took at Spa. That is literally the only thing separating the two teams at the moment, because there's 1 point at the top of the championship, which is pretty cool, I think. Even though we're only halfway through, the fact that the gap is that small at this stage is pretty exciting, don't you reckon?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think the Alpine team is going to be able to hold off any of the Jackie Chan cars until the end of the season. I think they'll need to get lucky with another Le Mans win, with a class win, with the extra points that go along with that. Yeah, it's going to be tough.
It is going to be tough. And I think I'm kind of the more the season goes on, the more and more scared I am of JCDC. I didn't expect them to be this good because they don't have any platinums, and it still breaks my brain, the fact that they're that quick. So maybe it'll break my brain all the way to the finale where they win the championship. Who knows? We'll see.
Spoilers.
Sorry, guys. Sorry for spoiling that for you. Move on now just to GTM to round off the talk about Fuji. Interestingly, this race was won by first-time winners, Project One Motorsport, which is awesome that another team has been able to come in and win a race, a WEC race, stepping up from, I think... I didn't even know if they stepped up from the ELMS or where they've come from, but that team has been really impressive lately, and for them to go over win the fashion that they did, they dominated that race. They were unstoppable with the entire thing.
Yeah, I think they've come. I hate this word, but the winningest Porsche 911 team. If that's right, with the GT3 racing and like cup racing, that sort of thing in Europe, okay. More like a German thing. But yeah, again, like I commented after Silverstone, the AM driver, I did another comparison, just like in LMP2, where they get the now bronze driver, Perfetti. Was really good in the start of the race in the wet, but also in the dry, in his other stint, was really, really, really good. He was unfortunate to get spun around by a Toyota, and also I think he did another spin at the hairpin, or at the chicane rather.
Okay.
But still, like, he made up for that with consistent, quick laps.
See, I can't even remember those spins. They mustn't have been all that drastic because I don't think I ever saw them come off the top of the timesheets after that first wet stint, which was amazing. But yeah, and I am just looking at these graphs that you've put up again. Check out the blog because it's great. And it does look like that that 56 car was just had the most consistent amateur drive. And when you pair that up with Patrick Lindsay and Jörg Bergmeister, they were just able to maintain that lead ahead of the Dempsey Proton number 88 car, which had a special AM driver in. Well, maybe not special, but an unusual AM driver in with, who was it? Satoshi Hoshino, who was filling in at his home race for what is normally, I think, Khaled Al-Kabaisi's drive. So they were initially in second place, there was a bit of some another post-race drama with fuel involved, which saw the number 88 and number 77 cars, the two Proton cars, get post-race penalties for fueling irregularities, which makes this I think it's every single race this season where there has been post-race disqualifications or penalties in the WEC, which is just ridiculous.
Not another one.
Yeah.
It's really, really frustrating to have the teams thinking that they can just get away with it. I mean, this is ridiculous, changing the data logger signals.
So what do they actually do? I'm still not 100% sure on what actually happened.
The way I understand it is that they refueled their cars too fast, and then the data logger that measures how long it takes, either from when the fuel nozzle touches the car and then it's released, or the fuel flow starts flowing and stops flowing, or however they measure it, they were altering that signal to the data logger, to the kind of central computer or whatever, and they were removing 2 seconds off that time, adding 2 seconds to that time, of course. So they were 2 seconds, or they were under time by refueling too quickly, and then they were adding time to then get over the requirement. Wow. So, you know, we're talking about tiny, tiny gaps in terms of what could be first to third to fifth, whatever, on the track. And yeah, you might think 2 seconds here, 2 seconds there, that's not worth it. But if you look at the ELMS race at Silverstone,
yeah, that was won
on countback in a ridiculously close finish, you know, having one super fast cheaty pit stop, that could be the difference between first and third.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I just can't believe that teams look. I'm looking at the press release from DSC, who wrote a little article about it, and they said Proton have said they have denied any knowledge of such a function, and the stewards have directed an investigation. So Proton have basically said we don't know why this has happened, but if there's any involvement that the team has had to change that signal, that's a big no-no, and I can't understand, if that's the case, why teams think they can get away with this sort of stuff. It's just it's a bit much.
Also, to think of it this way, if the team has the ability to find these signals or to kind of, you know, break into these signals being transmitted, and it's done on some sort of code that the teams are able to sort of add to the car somehow, then it's going to be a race of trying to be able to be who can hide the code
the best.
The best. You know, there's this kind of old saying, I guess, that everyone cheats in motorsport, and it's just the ones who are caught. It's who can sort of hide what they're doing
The best.
It's unfortunate. It's just crap.
Yeah. That's one way of putting it.
To look at a positive note in the pit lane, the Project One team and the Aston Martin team, they both had the fastest bronze drivers, but amazingly, they had consistently or across those three cars, the slowest cumulative pit stop times or total pit lane time. That was pretty much down to the tyre strategy early on, I guess, because they had extra, it looked like extra or slower pit stops or extra stops at the start of the race, and then managed to maintain that. And then looking at per stop, I'll just share that with you as well. Looking at per stop, the Project One team weren't really up there, but they still managed to get it done on track.
That's actually really interesting, because normally we find that, you know, you can spend X amount of money to gain a tenth or two on track, but lose it all in the pit lane. So it's interesting that even though that they were struggling in the pit lane, the teams like the Project One and the two Aston Martin teams, which ended up rounding out the podium, were able to make that sort of time back. It does a lot of encouragement. It does show a lot of encouragement for the likes of Edigo Perfetti and Sally Ulloch and Paul Dallalana in those cars. Then actually surprises me that the 98 would have been so slow. I would have expected an outfit that's been around the WEC for that long would have been much more on top of things.
And it was also compounded by the extra spins as well.
For the 98. AMR.
Yeah.
Mm. So to wrap up on Fuji, unless you had anything more that you wanted to add, Trovosaurus?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty much covered it. There just was just a little extra thing. I noted down that the Dragon Speed decided to take a risk, I guess, and go in their Le Mans specification of Aero.
Oh, so the low downforce kit.
Yeah, I think they were taking a risk maybe on the long straight, maybe to gather some more data for future Le Mans attempts. Yeah, it was interesting to say the least.
Cool. That's a very interesting point. Yeah, I wonder why they would have done that. Maybe looking towards Le Mans or even further, actually. Because they of course didn't have Heinrich Hedman in the car. They were running with James Allen and Ben Hanley instead. So, yeah, it's interesting to think if they made that decision based on the drivers or based on a testing schedule or, yeah, what? Good pickup. Final thoughts on the race then. Did you... of course, this was almost immediately after Petit Le Mans. Were you able to stay up for both? Did you end up watching both back-to-back?
No, definitely not. I definitely didn't do that. I woke up pretty early on the Sunday and watched the last, I think, 1.5 hours of Fuji. So I got a nice little battle in GTE to finish the race. And GT Pro as well.
Cool. Yep. I think this was probably overshadowed a little bit by how cool the ending of Petit Le Mans was. It was still a decent race, especially in GT. GT race was very, very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Intense.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. It was intense all the way up to the very end of the last stint. So, if you have missed it, it is up on YouTube now, so check it out. Especially focus on the GT battle, because the GT battle was quite good. We'll leave it at that in Fuji, and we're going to talk a little bit now about the upcoming 2020-2021 hypercar, quote-unquote, regulations, which have now finally been released. We actually have some concrete sort of numbers and parameters to actually talk about, which is very, very important considering we are only like 20 months away from actually racing these cars. Which, when I say it aloud, is kind of scary, isn't it?
Well, we still have a kind of shell of a set of regulations. Mm. It's kind of a bit of a teaser. I believe in December, it might not be public, but I think they would be privately finalized. They are still subject to change. I've heard of some from various OEMs at the table. I've heard of some discontent with certain things of the rules.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone is trying to align the rules with what they want. So everyone's going to be fighting for something. But I have heard of some people still, you know, requiring some changes to be made.
Yep.
So we'll see if significant changes are made in that. And I might comment on that a little bit later on as well.
Cool. So not everyone has been extremely happy with it, but it does at least give us a bit of a signpost of where things are going. So the big thing that everyone's been sort of talking about has been cost control and driving down costs while still maintaining development. So the idea, the big sort of like headline of these regulations that some people are happy with, some people aren't happy with, is the cost sort of cap, quote unquote. It's like a cost cap, but it's not a cost cap. The idea is that you're aiming for a budget of around 20 million euro per season for two cars. But the idea is that even if you invest more than that amount, you shouldn't be able to develop your cars beyond the certain targets. Now, as far as how possible that is to achieve, I don't know how possible that is to police again. I don't know. It almost, the regulations kind of point towards some level of like balancing, but not balancing. It's kind of like they're trying to set up the regulations so that way they're balanced without actually having to apply balance of performance to them. Now, for a category which is going to become the new LMP1, do you think that is the correct way to go?
Well, historically, LMP1 is, you know, it's pure prototype. It's striving to get those little extra gains through development throughout the whole season. And then, you know, that's kind of starting to fall away with the Toyota now only having two homologations locked in throughout the whole super season. And I guess the same for the next season again, being locked in to, and also, you know, the privateers aren't going to be able to match that, so you know we're not going to be able to have updates every single race like we could have had in the past for the OEMs. It's interesting because you kind of want it to be pure prototype, but you know, this isn't sprint racing. This isn't supposed to be door to door like supercars or, you know, touring cars.
It's a sports cars. Yes.
Does it need to be to compete in terms of, you know, being marketable as a product to TV, you know, for ratings? Does it need to be door to door, bumper to bumper, shedding bodywork, or, you know, is this kind of engineering pushing the boundaries not good enough?
Well, I kind of think that if you have regulations that set up to encourage development and competition, you get as a consequence occasions of door-to-door sort of action. So if you think about the WEC over the past six or seven seasons, I mean, the WEC itself has only been a thing since 2013, but if you look even further towards the Intercontinental Le Mans Cup and that sort of stuff, you do see instances where manufacturers in LMP1 have been so close that you do get door-to-door action and swapping paint and close finishes after 24 hours. Like, I mean, you look at the 2016 season, just in general, the amount of, like, the Toyota, Porsche, and Audi were so close in development that they were basically on top of each other at every single track. So as a consequence of the regulations,
I mean that as a kind of byproduct. Mm. So like you mentioned, that's a good example of this. You know, we have a byproduct of good racing.
Yeah.
We're fortunate in that way. But if we have, you know, a bit of a difference in technology and in development, a different, you know, like you see in Truth in 24, the documentary, yeah, you have one car that's significantly faster and then you have the Audi that can go longer. That's not necessarily going to promote door-to-door racing, but you still have pure endurance racing,
yeah,
in terms of going further for long, you know, going, yeah, longer for faster, fewer, yeah, pit stops, etc., you know. So it's the difference in perspective of going for the door-to-door racing as a number one goal or having it as a byproduct.
Yep.
That was kind of my point.
Yeah. I think, one of the big things that have been put up about this as well is that they're looking to excite media and fans, and that kind of points more towards the former, that you're looking for that to be your product. But I don't really get on board with that. There are a few things, though, that I do get on board with. The idea that there's got to be some level of brand identity. Not that they're homologated road-going hypercars, which has never been the case. They're just called hypercar because it's, I guess, a little bit lazy and kind of drives home the idea that they're meant to be recognizable for each brand, but they're based on cues and design ideas that are unique to a particular manufacturer. Because there isn't actually any homologation requirement in terms of like having to build road cars for these cars. You don't have to build a road car based on one of these cars that you're trying to enter into this series, which is, you know, which means that you can sort of not go a bit crazy with aerodynamics, but it can be a bit more like sort of DPI style aerodynamics where you've got a prototype kind of look, but you've also got design cues from your brand, which also kind of limits the aerodynamic development. There is a limit on the aerodynamic development. There are drag and downforce targets, which I think is actually a good thing because if you're trying to be road relevant, one of the things that you should be worrying about least is aerodynamics, because no car on the road gets up to the speed where aerodynamics comes into play. And yet, if you want to be a fast race car, one of the biggest areas you have to concentrate on is aerodynamics, because that's where a lot of your high speed grip comes from. So we're going to see limits in that respect. But I don't actually think that's such a bad thing, do you?
Well, as a devil's advocate to that previous statement, drag is still extremely important for road car development.
Okay, yeah, drag, yes.
Because of its really significant importance on emissions and fuel usage.
Yep. Okay, I'll concede that, yep.
But I do agree, though, on downforce. You know, this is only going to be applicable for the next, let's say, GT2 RS or GT3 RS or whatever,
yeah,
you know, which has a big wing hanging out the back. To your average saloon car, whatever, it's not going to be that much of an issue. Mm. It's just, stability at high speed kind of thing. That's pretty much the only thing. But anyway, I don't know, like, it's frustrating because looking into it from afar, from my perspective, it's going to be frustrating to look at how they're going to measure those things, those parameters. How are they going to, you know, make sure that that car, without taking a portable wind tunnel that, you know, to each track and set it up in the car park, how are they going to, you know, accurately and repeatably make sure that each car is running to specification without a little bit of, a little change here, a little change there? You know, they're supposed to be locked in to the homologation throughout the whole year. Are they going to be using strain gauges? Are they going to look at in the suspension to look at suspension load through the downforce? Are they going to do coast down tests on the straights? Are they going to do? Yeah, it's all messy. Also, where does active aero come into that? You know, are we going to scrap active aero? Is active aero going to be part of the measurable drag lift? You know what? It's all.
I actually don't think there has been any word on active aero since these regulations have had to be remade, so I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think that is a wise way to go. I do understand why it's being done, because of, you know, active aero can be extremely powerful to, you know, everyday cars. Now the technology is getting more and more achievable for the, you know, for on a budget. I mean, we've got active body panels now as road cars, so
So yeah, we might that might be something they look to evolve the regulations into, maybe. But I just want to quickly talk about some of the cost cutting measures that they've mentioned. Just to give you an idea, just give listeners an idea if they haven't heard already, of the sort of things that the WEC is looking at to try and attract manufacturers and other people into the sport and have it still be interesting. So firstly, we're not going to have any tire war in LMP, in LMP whatever, whatever it's called. It'll be a single tire supplier. There's going to be reduced testing and no testing during the overseas season. No access to the cars outside race weekends. And then collective tests. The idea is you're cutting down on personnel time and testing and transport times by sort of limiting things and having them all group as well. So ERS and engine limits, limitation in crew numbers, and a reduced pit stop area. So only one boom per two-car team. So very similar to the way that, for example, V8 Supercars or Formula One has their garages sort of set out, all to try and cut down on operating costs. But in terms of development costs, they've kind of gone down the Formula E road in terms of saying that if you want to build an engine and a privateer, a powertrain, which has its own limitations on it, you must offer that engine and powertrain hybrid system for purchase for any privateer to buy at 2 million euros for two cars. So that kind of spells out, like, you can invest as much as you want into this, but you must sell it at this fixed price point, which I think is an interesting way of trying to cost control, and it is something that has seen some level of success in Formula E. So yeah, it kind of does mute the development cycle, but, you know, ultimately we don't want another round of 5 years of awesome racing before another explosion, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be sustainable, especially when you go to a whole new big set of regulations. You know, as an example, in F1 recently, it was found that or revealed that the new regulations, which has cost a lot of money in development costs to then implement per team, isn't really getting the change that was intended. So then all that development cost has gone down the drain.
Yeah,
so it needs to be, you know, right first time, in that we don't have to then redevelop a new solution 4 years down the line to then waste even more money.
Mm. Which is, yeah, exactly not what manufacturers want. Because remember, at the end of the day, motorsport is a marketing exercise for a lot of these manufacturers. You know, these companies, while they might be race fans, they're not out here to race just because for the fun of it. They're racing to try and sell a product. And you want to have some level of return on investment. Otherwise, there's no point racing, at least at this level. So, yeah, it's important that these regulations are right the first time. I must say, though, it is encouraging that we actually have something now. And what's more encouraging is we actually have an entrant with Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus actually committing to a two-car WEC 2020-2021 regulation team effort. So we actually have a confirmed entrant at this stage for 2020-2021, which is big. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's we finally kind of, you know, got our first. We've had Toyota all along, but you know, to have our first sort of privateer really having a real stab at it, it bodes well for if Glickenhaus can, you know, have a go. What's stopping us? Kind of,
yeah. What's stopping Porsche? What's stopping McLaren? What's stopping Aston Martin, who have been in the room? What's stopping Ferrari? Yeah. Or yeah.
It's that, you know, if you're a little budding, you know, enthusiast with a fair amount of money, you know, what's stopping us? What's stopping me? Kind of that kind of mentality. And if, you know, if you listen to Mr. Glickenhaus speak, you know, he's really into it and he's passionate and he cares and he wants to do it properly.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and this isn't just a little messy thing. This is, you know, a real proper.
Yeah, this is the real deal. For those who don't know Glickenhaus, who haven't heard of Glickenhaus before, they're a company run by a New York-based entrepreneur called James Glickenhaus, who has been running cars in the Nürburgring 24-hour race over the past few seasons, which are GT3 spec cars that are road legal. So the idea being that you can drive up to a race, and then drive home and not have to worry about the car not being legal on the road. So while they are GT3 spec, they are not GT3 homologated, because of course, being a small manufacturer, they haven't produced the number of cars required for actual GT homologation purposes. But he has been looking at going to Le Mans, and it appears that with the LMP1 regulations as they are, well, the future regulations, he's been able to jump at the opportunity, which is fantastic. And what I think is really cool, and this is such a Glickenhaus thing, he has made mention that the cars may come with a road conversion kit. So I think the plan, I didn't actually hear him talk about it on the Midweek Motorsport show with Radio Le Mans, but I remember hearing somewhere that he did make mention of the fact that he wants to be able to race a car at Le Mans and then drive it away from Le Mans, to kind of harken back to the days where you could actually just do that.
That used to be a requirement.
Yeah, which would be hilarious.
I think the only changes that would need to be made are tyres and engine. So if you can get an engine swap done and swap the tyres, then you could, you know, go down and go for dinner after you've won the race, sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's a nice hotel.
Yeah, he's made the mention on this DSC article. I know there's a real appeal to some that these cars might be capable from being driven to Le Mans from Turin, where they'll be based, to race at the 24 hours and then drive to Paris for dinner after the race. Like, yeah, sign me up for that.
It's not the best from a sporting perspective, having that unnecessary engine mileage.
but
before
it's
the race.
Yeah, but it's hilarious, isn't it?
I love it. I think it's whack, and I think it's brilliant.
Yep. And just to sort of give people an idea of the sort of like how serious these this team is. This car took SCG 003 took pole at the 24 Hours of Nürburgring on the Nordschleife in 2016. So these guys know how to build a car, and if they're committing to this, it's a big deal. So it's cool that they're coming along, and I hope that this gives some manufacturers something to think about.
Yeah, and looking at that car, the pole sitter, it's the one based on GT3 regs. The Jim claims that this car, despite being, well, not homologated, but being in around GT3 performance, it has the aerodynamic efficiency of an LMP2 car, which is sort of in the ballpark of what the new hypercar regs will be based around, which is really significant. And that they, because they are so good, that they need to have the most ballast, the lowest boost to counter that in terms of balance of performance. So, you know, I'd like to see what this kind of form factor in car can manage to do when it's unleashed of its
GT3 sort of
ballast
origins. Yeah. Kind of looks like a Senna, to be honest. It looks like a Senna before the Senna was a Senna.
Yeah, I guess. And a bit of Ford GT as well.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely. If you haven't seen this before, check it out. Just search up SCG003 or Cameron or Glickenhaus, which is spelt basically exactly as you reckon it is, except it's a German sort of thing, so it's HAUS at the end. But yeah, check it out, because this is a big deal.
Do you want to have a little bit on McLaren stuff, or
do you want to volunteer some information on McLaren stuff?
Well, I can add a little bit of context to, okay.
I'll jump my feet into that. So McLaren have just released the new Speedy Tail, the Speedy Boy, a car that can really reach stupid amounts of speed and look stupid amounts of cool. But they have said that Zach Brown has come out and said that they don't want to enter the 2020 season of the WEC in this hypercar class because they haven't really given a reason yet. But it's kind of along the lines of we're not sure that we want to do that yet. So are you able to shed any light on that at all?
Yeah, just a tiny bit. So, something I can say is that the Speed Tail is not to race unless someone decides to, take it to a track day, pretty much.
So it's just it's an exercise in engineering wankery.
It's the Speed Tail is a luxury GT car that happens to go really fast. It's a ultra luxury sports car. That's pretty much, it's not a racing car.
Fair enough.
Yes, it has some nice fitted luggage. It has, you know, it's not a car that will be going down a racetrack straight, unless it's doing a top speed run. That's basically where I am with that car. But then also, based on the statements or the quotes about lack of confidence in going into the first season of the new regulations with a McLaren, a potential McLaren entrant. So to add some context to that, we have our business plan at the moment is called Track 25, and that includes a quite significant hybridization. And also, on a new P1. Now, I'm talking about P1 as in the road car P1, not as in the class LMP1. Yep. So for the next couple of minutes, P1 will be talking about road car P1, not race car P1.
Yep, yep.
So for a future P1 replacement, quote, the new P1 will arrive towards the end of the slew of new models. And this track 25 plan is, you know, around 2025. So, you know, it's a long way off, let's say, this new ultra, mega, whatever prefix you want to call car. As I said, the products are, across the range are transitioning to hybrid. The way we say it is McLaren reserves the right to keep Ultimate Series cars just petrol. So we reserve the right to have something crazy that is not hybrid just because we can. And maybe a high net worth individual doesn't want to have a car that's hybrid. So you could argue that, you know, this set of new regulations has a high level of road relevancy with the McLaren road car products. Can you say that the same about that with Aston Martin? Have they, you know, publicly said that they've got a big strategy for hybridization of the road car models? So that's interesting to me. They have got some electric things like the electric Rapide, but I haven't seen one on the road. You know, I don't know how many have been sold. I don't know if anyone has been sold. So looking at the P1, it was the first hybrid supercar. It was the first of the big three, let's say. And obviously you'd expect then the future P1 to also be hybrid. So there's a tie in there. It's part of the business plan. So that system, that kind of ultra high performance system is being looked at in terms of research and development. And also McLaren is all about really pushing boundaries. If you imagine the ramp of development of LMP1 hybrid battery technology, imagine that kind of trajectory put on a road car, and imagine how, you know, bonkers that kind of performance is going.
Oh boy.
Also, future road cars out there that I know of have battery technology developed from LMP1 hybrid cars. So you have that trickle down, that road relevancy that we are seeing now,
which has always been
that ridiculous.
Yeah. Which has always been the entire point. Like, that's why you saw brands like Porsche and like Audi and like Toyota get into the LMP1 games, because they were developing those systems and they needed to have some place to sort of go bonkers with them. And now they're reaping the rewards in their road cards.
Yeah. And I do believe that the supplier for the cells of the 919 hybrid are then now going into future road car developments in the industry, which is insane. Like, the cells that are in the car from the 919 hybrid are going to be in future road cars, which is bonkers.
Yeah.
So if you look at that and then compare it to the new regulations, and we're stepping down in battery technology from where we are now, let's say, if we are, then, you know, is this undercutting these kind of high, ultra high development, research and development projects? If racing is going down in performance and the road car is going up in performance, then we would need to add ballast to a road car hybrid battery to make it legal to race, which is utterly bonkers. And then if the power development and energy, the power density and the energy density levels are capped, and we can't develop that with research and development, then the research and development is just going to be going into, for the smaller manufacturers, going into just reliability alone. So we won't have the same ridiculous ramp in performance. And then going on to, I've been fortunate enough to chat with a research and development engineer for hybrid systems, and they've sort of been part of a kind of focus group, as in pretty much every OEM at the table has focus groups for these kind of things, just kind of, you know, making some models of what a car could be like, kind of thing. And he was talking about skepticism with front only hybrid systems, and that's what I'm talking about with other OEMs potentially wanting some certain change, because the ability to harvest on the front axle is just for braking events, and braking events in terms of duration aren't that long. There is an extreme energy transfer in that time, you know, brakes get super hot, as an example, in such a short amount of time. So there is energy there, but the trouble is the energy is only being transferred for a short amount of time. Whereas if you use, for example, a 919 hybrid solution that has a generator motor unit on the
turbocharger,
then you can have a sustained harvesting strategy. And also, if you lock up one corner, then you might lose all harvesting for the corner. Mm. Whereas, you know, with a rear system, you can kind of balance out that those kind of mistakes.
So is this talking just in motorsport applications or in road applications as well?
So just having, just this is with a motorsport context. Yep. And then there's the whole skepticism of, you know, if you have the energy being harvestable lower by not having any from the rear axle, then you limit your harvestable energy by the momentum of the car. And so that's a kind of fixed value. If you have, let's say, a race lap with expected top speeds and expected braking amounts, then you can kind of compare that with the deployable energy. And there's, from that numbers, potentially some skepticism on, you know, if there's enough harvestable energy or not. But then also, you know, it's less efficient to have it this way. Is that representative of a future ultra high performance car? You know, are we gonna then make a road car lower performance, or are we gonna push the boundaries like want to? To then, you know, get a real bonkers sports car.
Yeah. Look, I think that if you're, there will always be a market for absolutely bonkers tech in road cars. So I don't really think, and also some of them are sort of vanity projects. So, like, you know, the 918 was originally a concept vanity project that they turned into a road car. The P1 as well became a vanity project. A look what we can do if we go absolutely all out sort of thing. But they don't have the added factor of having to participate in a series, a competition, which has entertainment dollars at stake, not just, part of the whole sports cars as a marketing device is only really as good as the entertainment product that it can produce. Maybe not entirely, because you can still say, hey, look, we won at Le Mans and look at us, you know, thrash that about a bit. But, you know, there is some level of responsibility that has to be enjoyable to watch. Otherwise, people aren't going to care about it. And I think that's where the ACO's motivation for kind of drawing things back a bit and making this sort of competition more accessible has come from. So yes, you're not going to see the absolute peaks of efficiency or the peaks of development or, you know, crazy jerry-rigged solutions like, you know, a rear harvesting hybrid system or, you know, whatever Nissan were going to do before that thing crashed and burned. We're not going to see that because it's going to be more accessible, which will make it more competitive and more controlled. So while it might not align with, you know, the business interests of, say, McLaren or someone like Porsche, who have already developed these systems by being in the WEC for the last few seasons, or Audi or BMW, who are moving to hydrogen-powered electric systems, it does mean that you can get a few more groups interested by starting at a lower price point.
But would this, on the other hand, as a devil's advocate, make this less accessible to McLaren because it's too low-tech?
I don't necessarily think so. I think that seeing as McLaren has these sort of things going on already, they should be able to just kind of walk in and test their equipment within the regulations. Because, I mean, you're not going to... Not every car that McLaren makes or any mark makes is going to be the flagship, right? So why not test some of these lower things as well?
And also, you know, these kind of hybrid initiatives are already being developed for future road cars. What's not saying that a company that's making these hybrid systems just market a unit and just say, here we go.
Buy this unit and put it in your road car.
Yeah, the development cost in terms of the rules, you know, the development cost isn't part of it. So, you know, the development cost can be also attributed to road car development. So then you've, let's say, got this standalone system that's already designed for road cars that's high performance. Then what's stopping you? Which is, you know, a potential path.
Interesting. Very interesting. It does... we are at a bit of a crossroads here, and it's not necessarily the best crossroads to be at because, yeah, we are talking about cutting costs and making it accessible and stopping crazy development, which in this day and age is like trying to stop a 20-ton freight train with 100 million carriages from, you know, however fast a freight train can go down to zero, because that's just sort of the pace of the world we live in. But at least it's looking encouraging. And hopefully come 14, 15 months, when we're looking to ramp into Le Mans 2019, Le Mans 2020 rather, we can look ahead to the off season and the start of the 2020 season and go, yes, we've got a good grid forming, which could potentially give us a good competition. Because as fans, that's what I want to see. I want to see a good competition and I want to see an enjoyable series to watch. And with that comes, as a byproduct comes development and technology. I mean, some people watch for the development and technology themselves. I wouldn't necessarily put myself in that category, but I just want to watch good racing. And if we can get both of them in the same jar, then that's fantastic. If we have to sacrifice one for a bit more of the other, then I guess that's okay, but I wouldn't want to sacrifice too much of the good competition, which has kind of been where we're at this season.
Yeah, and if we can get a McLaren at Le Mans with Lanzanti running it, then that would be the icing on the cake.
Yeah, exactly. Especially considering their 25th anniversary for their first Le Mans win is coming up soon, isn't it?
Yeah, that would... Well, I think it's too late now to sort of have a car ready to race, but what an occasion that would be if they would be something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh well, that would be cool. Yeah. So we should move on now. I think we've talked about the new regs a bit too much before we know too much about them. But it's good that we actually have something to talk about, which is nice. This weekend we have Shanghai, the 6 hours of Shanghai, the last round of the World Endurance Championship for this calendar year, the fifth round of the super season, and the first round that kind of kicks off the second half of the season. We have 35 cars competing in Shanghai, which is one more than we had at Fuji. Again, we're going to be minus the Ginettas, minus the two CEFC TRSM cars. But we have gained a one-off Corvette entry featuring Tommy Milner and Oliver Gavin, which looks pretty damn sick. So we'll have now six GTE manufacturers in the pro class, which is awesome. A big fat goose egg next to TRSM. There's too many acronyms in that name. TRSM in their own country, which again, very discouraging signs.
Yeah, and they were on the poster as well, the official poster for the race, because they're under racing under the Chinese flag. They put pride of place on the official race poster for Shanghai, and they're not even going to be there.
Yeah, really, really not great. It's gonna be a long way if we ever see them at Le Mans. I think the only way we see them again is if they get themselves to Le Mans. I don't see them turning up at Sebring for starters.
They've paid for the season in full for at least one car, I believe, and so at least one car should be making it to Le Mans. If they can get to any single race of the season, it's going to be Le Mans, hands down. So yep, if there's going to be one race that they're ever going to go to, they've paid for it. They just need to get the funds to pay for mechanics, fuel, whatever.
Yep.
Fingers crossed.
On top of that, there are one or two changes in the car lineups. So Bicolas has a TBA in its seat because James Rossiter, the Super GT driver, will not be in the car for the Shanghai race. Renger van der Zander joins Dragon Speed because it's not clashing with Petit Le Mans anymore. But James Allen stays in the Dragon Speed car as well. So they're not going to Heinrich Hedman. That might be due to Heinrich Hedman's business commitments, but James Allen will stay in that car for another round, which is interesting. I don't know why. Honestly, I don't know why you'd put all that effort into trying to get into LMP1 and then miss half the rounds, but that's just me. So we'll see what happens with that car. TDS Racing, Loic Deval rejoins after missing out at Fuji, and so replacing John Eric Verne, who was subbed into that car for that round. There's a change at Labra, so Enzo Guibert, which is a name that is that from ELMS? I feel like I've mentioned that name from ELMS.
I think Enzo's been. Yeah, I don't think he's raced in that car before because it's been three bronzes since the start of the season. So, yeah, I think it's in LMP2 in ELMS.
I'm just going to have a quick look at an entry list from ELMS to just sort of have a look.
Is it TDS?
I think it might be. Either that or the Graf car.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm... Yeah.
Yeah. Hang on. Not that one. That one. So that's interesting because now we've gone from three bronze car drivers to potentially a. I reckon it is the Graf car. Excuse us while we just try and work this out. Sorry.
I'm looking through.
Oh, he started the season. So Paul Ricard and Monza. He was with Graf. There we go. We did it, everyone. We figured it out.
Woo.
we're so excited about it. So I'm just going to cut all that out and say it's good that he's stepping up from the Graf car into the Labra car after having a break of the season. And there's currently a TBA next to the number 88 DMC Proton car. But more importantly, there has actually been another boost to the LMP1 privateer's fuel allowance in the EOT for the LMP1 privateers. So it's a pretty significant boost, isn't it?
Yeah, almost 10% for both turbo and naturally aspirated, which is a pretty hefty chunk of fuel.
It's huge. It's an astounding amount.
The fuel usage for Fuji, for the privateers, was still heavily under control in terms of the engineers constantly staring at the fuel allocation per lap number as it creeps down to zero. Hopefully, they don't have to keep doing that and concentrate on strategy and other things.
And that's also come with a small change to the fueling restrictors as well, to allow that extra fuel to be able to jump in at the same time as it used to. But 10%, hopefully this means that we don't have to see lifting and coasting, and we can actually see a full-blown privateer lap around in angle without exceeding the fuel limit.
And that's going to be more significant, tying in with what I said at the Fuji round discussion earlier on, was the performance on the straights. So lift and coast is generally done on straights before at maximum speed. And without this, it means that the privateers are going to be braking later, so their performance is going to be even higher on the straights. And if the privateers are already a nuisance on the straights and requiring the privateers to boost at the start finish line, then it's going to be even worse. But what we have, or even worse for the privateer, for the hybrids.
Yeah.
But there's a big difference between the long straight at Fuji and the long straight in Shanghai. And that is, there isn't a start finish line where you can refresh your allocation of hybrid. So we're going to have a real nuisance made from the privateers. It's going to be interesting to see if how the Toyotas control their hybrid usage around the lap to remain having enough in the tank to discharge along that straight to try and get a cap.
Yeah, and it'll be real cool as well, because Shanghai has a lot more of those long straights compared to Fuji. Fuji only really has the one, whereas at Shanghai, you've got the back straight and you've got the main straight, and there's a few other places around the track. So this could actually see, we could legitimately see some of the privateers actually take it to the Toyotas. Fingers crossed.
But also we have more downforce for the privateers as well, if they so choose to use their highest downforce settings, setups. So, you know, we saw at Fuji an SMP overtake around a corner of a Toyota, and we also had an overtake on the straight. So, you know, let's have more of them.
Yes, please. But then,
also talking about the circuit layout and the, you know, more weighting towards straight. I'd be interested to see the setup changes, if there are some. You know, will Dragon Speed stay with the low drag kit? Will SMP
move to the low drag kit?
Or take off some of their extra high downforce parts that they didn't have at
Silverstone
previous tracks and things. So we'll see.
Interesting. Very interesting. I do like this sort of unknown that we go into, but I hope that it's more of a closer battle, and we don't end up with like a few laps between the top two, or between the Toyotas and everyone else, because that's no fun. No one wants to see that. Just a quick touch on GT balance of performance. We've made mention earlier that the Ferrari is actually getting a bit heavier through the auto BOP system. It's getting 5 kilograms, whereas the Aston Martin gets 6 kilograms lighter, and also a bit more power at Shanghai. So that bodes well to bring the Aston Martin even further into competition. As we were just saying, at Fuji, it looked the part in the early stints before falling off after making a few weird strategy calls. But the rest of the cars are actually running exactly the same as well. So as same as they were at Fuji. So I hope that these small changes aren't going to change the balance too much, because I got to say the balance performance at Fuji was pretty on point.
Yeah, Ferrari was still faster. It's just that they were unlucky. So reining them in a little bit is understandable. Aston Martin... Are they going to get another pole position? You know, they've got even more power and less weight, and they already managed pole position. Also, as a little extra, there's a class-wide change in ballast as well. So every car is down 5 kilos to create a little bit more of a gap in performance between the amateur cars. So... Yep. The amateur cars are going to be less of a nuisance.
Oh, but I love Patrick Long getting in the mix of the GTE Pro field, or Pedro Lamy, or I just love that. Why did they take that away from me?
It's interesting when an AM has new tires and they can just, you know, get really in the way of a nice battle.
It's great, isn't it? And the Corvette is running, I think it's just around the same mass as the Ferraris. The air restrictor is, I think, the same as it was at Le Mans. I'm not 100% sure. It is difficult. It must be difficult to be able to just chuck it into the auto BOP system and kind of have it spit a number out. So hopefully it's competitive. Because otherwise that would be kind of crap to see the Corvette just kind of appear and be nowhere.
Yeah, we'll see. It's difficult with a new car coming in. You know, we only have data from Le Mans, which is a pretty unique track. And then we also maybe have some data from its time in IMSA, if IMSA are nice and sharing data, that kind of thing. We'll see. There's also a political thing of, you know, the WEC wants these OEMs to commit full time. So why are you going to give someone who just comes into this one event a lenient BOP?
Yeah.
You know, it's all messy politics.
Yeah. Yay. Love politics. What are we expecting at Shanghai? Are you brave enough to make some predictions?
Yeah, I've written down some predictions. For LMP1, I'm going to go for the 7.
Yep. Following on from their good race at Fuji.
Yeah. Conway had a really, really nice stint. It sort of broke the back of the race on against the sister car, which I've put in second, naturally.
Yep.
And then the best of the rest, I've gone for the 11. I've been really convinced by Button's performance at Fuji and, well, generally the car's performance. Like, yes, sure, it was crap with reliability.
Been crap with reliability.
You know, if is the big if. You know, if they can have a clean race for once, then, you know, hopefully I can... you know, get proved right. Who knows?
I will hesitantly agree with you. I reckon Button has been a stellar performer in that number 11 car. And if we're at somewhere with a lot of straight, I reckon the S&P is a bit better in a straight line. So I will say that the S&P finally gets one up on the Rebellion. Finally. What about LMP2? Are you still thinking, JCDC?
Yes, quote unquote home race
yep.
for the team based in England. I just can't go away from the 37s drivers' performances. It's
crazy.
I don't want to say it's, you know, Super Silver Pizzatola level, but they are extremely high performing silver drivers.
It's kind of crazy. I must have underrated them so much at the beginning of the season because I still can't wrap my head around it. But because you've gone the 37, I'm going to go the 38, but I really, really want the 36 to win still. Hate me if you want. I'm all about that Alpine.
Yeah, it's kind of split between the Dragon Speed and the Alpine for my third. I think that one comes down to tyres and pit lane, really, in terms of, you know, pit crew.
Yeah.
Because the Alpine crew is really good.
Yeah, super smooth. GT, this will be interesting. GT, who gets the ascendancy in GTE Pro?
So we've just been talking about BOP and the little tweaks there. So originally, before looking at the BOP numbers, I went from the Fuji results and kind of had a look at what, you know, going transmitting or translating this, the results and the pace going forward. So I first thought the Ferrari 71, but I've put them third. For my first pick, it was going to be a 911 because they performed really well on the straight. And like we said, there's quite significant straight line portions of the track. So I decided to pick the 91, but it's pretty much interchangeable.
Yep.
And then the BMW performed well, so I've gone for them as well, the 82.
Interesting. I'm gonna go with the 92 Porsche, because I rate Estra a fair bit, but I actually reckon the Fords are going to be the next biggest challenger. The Fords for me were one of the better cars in Fuji. They just didn't play the right cards at the end to build into that top position. So I actually reckon it's going to be the 66 or the 67 that takes that second position on the podium. So that's my call. Yeah, we'll see. I'll be interested to see where that Corvette slots in, actually. Whether or not they actually have the stuff to make a... If they get a top five, I'll be pretty impressed, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely.
And to round out, the GT AM.
So, like we mentioned with LMP2 and the amateur driver's performance, I'm going to go again, like we discussed, with the Project One, number 56. Yeah, despite not necessarily having the best pit lane performance, the track on track performance, I noted in person at Silverstone was great. And looking at Fuji, watching back, was great as well. So that's my number one. And then for number two, I'm going to go TF Sport number 90. Sally Yollett was really good again as the amateur driver. And Johnny Adam is getting more and more used to the old girl back driving the old V8 Vantage. So, yeah, hopefully that'll give them a bit more of an edge as you know, they're stepping up even more. And then I decided to go Dempsey Proton 77 for the third one. And I know you're going to put them number one.
I'm actually going to put them number two. I actually reckon this is going to be one for the Aston Martins of the world. The 98 is going to be my pick. Simply because I had a quick peek at last year's results and Christian Reed didn't have a good race. So it might be the fact that he just doesn't quite have a handle on this track. But last year, the Aston Martin won by over a lap. And considering that they had a semi-decent race last time out, ending up finishing on the podium, I reckon the Aston Martin is going to be the ones to beat. Sorry, I'm going to put the 98 first, and then the 77, hoping to bounce back from what was a torrid weekend at Fuji. And then I'm actually going to put the other Aston Martin, the number 90, the TF Sport Aston Martin, in third. Because, as you said, they were really impressive and were in with a shot of taking that second position away from the number 88 crew before the penalty came into effect. So I was really impressed by Eastwood and Sally Ullock in particular. So hopefully they have a good race. And we'll see how they go. Yeah, that really surprised you, didn't you? You would never have thought I'd pick a Aston Martin over the 77.
Well, especially considering Dalalana spun twice. So I bet you he's going to spin on the long right-hander at the first corner.
Okay, you're on. What are we betting here? And listeners, if you've got any idea what we should bet, let us know.
Nice McLaren pen. I don't know.
Unfortunately, I don't have a nice McLaren pen. So,
I know I'm going to lose, so that's why.
I don't know. It's a 6-hour race, man.
Yeah, exactly. He'll spin once on that corner.
Okay,
he will spin.
if any listeners has an idea of what we should bet and we both agree on it, then I'm totally down for this. Cool. Well, I think that brings us to the end. Thank you for being patient with us. Sorry that it's taking so long to do anything. Just kind of getting back into the swing of things, and it's been a crazy little bit of time. So yeah, thanks for being patient. And yeah, we should have another episode that's either just come out or looking to come out very soon, which will be organized by Kiwi Chris and Cookie Monster. So keep your eyes and ears out for that. Trevor Vasaurus, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
No problems. And we'll see everyone this weekend in Shanghai. Peace out.
Links. I didn't actually open any. Whoops.
Smooth. Now whenever I hear Link, all I can think of is Legend of Zelda, because I've just been playing the fuck out of Breath of the Wild. That's Kirby.
Oh shit.
Yeah, that's Gourmet Race by in Kirby.
Yeah. Shit. Alright then. Whatever.